Up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz Stream is the November 25th, 2018 edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Going to be trying to reach lots of local folks and some out-of-towners by phone. Not sure how successful we're going to be. We're going to review Thanksgiving thoughts at the, traditional Thanksgiving food line, where folks line up all along the Veterans Memorial Building for a relatively tasty meal once a year. That's nice. Maybe twice a year. And bits and pieces from some earlier interviews we haven't done, plus a few interesting articles on the legal struggles going on in the Bay Area, and that also have implications here because of the Martin v. Boise don't arrest homeless people for camping if you ain't got no shelter decision. Away we go.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
Okay, well, I have on the line with me Brent Adams, who is a day and night storage man, a winter shelter activist, and the online blogger around homeless outside in Santa Cruz. Hi, Brent. Say that again. My phone went burpy on you.
Good afternoon.
Hello. So, how are things going out there on Felker Street?
We're busy. You know, we're trying to work with the winter shelter. Warming Center did not activate during this last rain thing. The amount of rain for the storm didn't amount daily or over 2 days or over 3 days enough to activate our system. But we were going gangbusters here at the storage program because we're partnering, of course, with the winter shelter, the main shelter system, which has a pickup location in the cul-de-sac nearby on Felker Street here. Mm-hmm. And so we are seeing a lot of new people, seeing a lot of new people to town. I think our programs, you know, Warming Center and the day and night storage program are, and other programs like that, kind of see the first blush when people hit downtown. They're directed towards, you know, these programs that can help immediately. So, but it's really bizarre. You know, our aim is, and we don't mean to create a class designation between people who have been here for a while and people who are brand new. But at the same time, our programs are designed to help the pre-existing population improve their lives. We're not trying to be that, welcome mat.
Now, naturally, you're getting tens of thousands of dollars from the city to help you do this, right?
No, not a penny yet. We don't have for work in Santa Cruz, we don't have $1 for anything that we're doing.
How about...
Hopefully coming soon, because we have a budget request out for the county to, as we are expanding services for the Warming Center, you know, we're pledging to open for twice as many people. And we've stated we'd like to open twice as many nights to meet the extreme reduction in winter shelter beds that we're seeing.
How many, again, remind us, because I know you mentioned this before, how many nights last winter were you open?
We were open 20 or less on a very mild winter, and we ended up having to increase our temperature threshold 2 degrees upward, which in some of our peak winters would have had us open 30 and 40 nights.
So 20 nights out of a total of how many nights are in the winter, would you estimate?
I don't know. You know, we counted 5 months, so, you know.
That's That's about 130, 150. That's a lot of.
So we're in extreme weather. You know, I always
I understand.
Remind people. It's a.
I'm not criticizing. I'm just clarifying because you know
that allowed us to. What we did mostly last year was flesh out a whole new capacity, which is our hotline and the ability to deliver blankets and warm clothing. Nearly 24 hours, so we did that in a very robust fashion last year.
That kind of brings me to the question I was going to ask you before, which is you aren't getting any money yet from any government agencies that are supposed to be dealing with these issues, at least in some way. At least that's what they claim. They've got lots of propaganda about their winter shelter and the wonderful services and all that stuff. But what about private funding? Are you getting much of that compared to last year?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's all. I'm the CEO and program director of the Warming Center, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. And my main role there is to write grants. So I'm still new at it. I'm many people would do this role better, but I've been able to get a grant from the Community Foundation, a grant. Increased grant from emergency food and shelter program through the larger organization, through United Way. Again, it's 10,000 here and 5,000 there. We got 20 finally from Kaiser Permanente to help us system wide to always undergird our main priority, which is to help people with physical mobilities and mental health challenges. So. And that's mainly because we see across the country these types of programs don't put a priority on people in wheelchairs and walkers. When they do, they tend to leave them out. And so we're trying to make a challenge to the community at large that these have to be our highest priority, because we've seen year in, year out, every winter, people in wheelchairs and walkers left downtown on nights when the warming center doesn't open. So we see easily that the winter shelter hasn't been focusing on these people. And we as a community just kind of let that occur. How do we drive by or walk by from, you know, our dinner into a movie, seeing literally sometimes five or six walkers in wheelchairs, people sleeping on the concrete? We can't really do much about that on nights when we're not open as the warming center, but what we do is when we do open, we have, you know, it's very expensive to operate the shuttle that we have. And also when we are open, and we're engaging on opening 30 or more nights this winter, that those people are our main priority, in meaning they get first placement, and we reserve a whole section, because in a lot of shelters it's hard if a person has a walker or a wheelchair to wake up at 4 in the morning and to access the bathroom, because often those pathways are not left open.
Let me interrupt you here, and because that leads to two.
You were talking about funding, but yeah.
I was, but I also, I mean, you raised two questions I want to ask you about, you know, the facilities at the, you know, the 7th Avenue shelter, the Association of Faith Communities run shelter this year compared with last year. But I also want to ask about how does your funding this year from private sources compare with last year? Are you half as much, twice as much, the same amount? And what is that amount as of now?
We should have been more of a strong and stable warming center institution prior to reaching out with a completely brand new program, one that the cost will definitely eclipse and be quite a bit more than the warming center. So
you're talking about the day and night storage.
Day and night storage program is much more expensive because it actually has, you know, year-round staff and an actual leasable building and space. It's quite expensive. On top of all that nonprofit insurance, workers' comp and things like that. So, so we're trying to fundraise for that at the same time, right? Fundraising for the warming center. So I'm kind of in a program developmental snafu.
So how would you compare this year with last year? If we talk about all the combined.
Well, this year, we're at the beginning of the winter season. In fact, it's not even winter yet. I think that the day and night storage program had a really robust jump off of support, and right now we're seeing a lull there. We're seeing we're getting into seasonal giving or end of year giving. There are all these programs like Giving Tuesday or Santa Cruz Gives and things like that. So we'll see our aim here is to, and we had the last 2 years we performed very well in that Santa Cruz Gives thing, but that's a small part of our budget.
How does it compare with this year, let's say, at the end of November, if you looked at the amount of donations you got, and you can include everything, blankets, food.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How does that compare with this year?
Again, we're doing two programs instead of one.
I understand.
This year, much more, but Warming Center is actually so far getting far less. By this time last year, we were seeing community members writing $20 check, sending money in the mail, sometimes a $500 check. We're seeing a bit of that. Our technique in this program is not to do basic fundraising. What we do is build relationships within the community and have them, you know, we hold ourselves up to the light so you can see very clearly who we are, what we're about. If you look at any of the other programs, it's very opaque, and you're not welcome there. So that's how we do it. You know, we're volunteer-based, community-supported. So ideally, when people think about writing a check to any organization in town, they'll also think to writing another check to the Warming Center.
So in the interest of openness, how much money have you gotten this year compared to last year at this time?
We're just, again, budgetarily, October 1st is the beginning of our fiscal year, so it's almost impossible to count it that way. Mm-hmm. But I think we're seeing, like I said, the Warming Center, a bit of a dip compared to last year. Not able to share the numbers because those numbers aren't, you know, they're not up on the board. But I have strong belief that this year is going to far outpace.
Are we talking about thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands?
We're talking about tens of thousands of dollars.
Okay.
Organizationally wide, you've got a program, the day and night storage program, which will have a budget to $60,000 for the year. Warming Center program, which has a budget to about $40,000. So that's $100,000 for both. But that's a weird way to look at it. Organizationally also, they share some overlaps.
I understand. Let me cut through this because, you know, the details are interesting. But
why do you want to get granular here?
I don't really. That's one of the issues. And one of the, you know, I mean, people ask that question about, for example, they'll look at the, they'll wonder how much money goes into the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which of course is several million, you know, and
$5 million.
Yeah, really, is that what it is?
That's what they put on their N990 last year for the Santa Cruz Gives. It was $5 million. They've dropped it down to $3 million, so that's a lot of these things that we need some investigative reporting in town. You know, it's easy to look at the Warming Center and people have been critical, but these big dogs in town, like how much money goes into the United Way? What is really being spent there? What is income?
Oh, you know, no question, no question.
Yeah.
One question that was asked me was the famous sign on the side of the Homeless Lack of Services Center fence about, what is it, 743 or however many, you know, people housed. Do you have any sense of how accurate that is over how long a period it is and what the longevity of that housing is?
That's the one thing. That number should be held up in spotlights. You know, like, it should. That's the one number we should easily, like, these are the people who drilled into us for years, evidence-based. You have to show measurable results to be a smart solution. 180-20-20 were the people who crammed that down our throats. Where is the source of that data? We know that that number is somewhat suspicious. Now, I want to believe that many people have been quote-unquote housed, but they include in there transitional housing. They include in there the basic SROs, some of those places in Watsonville, or even places on their own campus that should never be considered housing, like Pate Smith or some of those spaces. You know, like, so, and the places that turn people out after 6 months, that's not housing. I have to play nice. I don't want to be critical, but but it's actually been beneficial that these terms like show measurable results and be a evidence-based program, because that's actually challenged small nonprofits like ours to work a little harder at you know, having a little bit of the ability to show results.
What about the question I asked you earlier, Brent, which is, if you look at the quality or the nature, the extent of the services provided, the number of people served, let's say as of the last couple of weeks, and it's only been open for a couple of weeks or even less, how does that compare last year with this year in terms of the, as far as you can tell, around the Association of Faith Communities run program. What's your sense of that?
Okay, Association of Faith Communities, you might mean the Salvation Army.
I do, yes.
Yeah. This year is the Salvation Army contract with the city of Santa Cruz. Also, the county is weighing very heavily there at the VFW, so that's three or four organizations. Then the way the AFC and other people work in is they work at a volunteer capacity in serving food. It's easy to be critical of a homeless shelter. You just have to show up and look around and point your finger in any direction and you'll find something to complain about. You can do that at the Warming Center program. So we are trying to be a sister organization currently. So to be the most, what I'm seeing in terms of you just simply asking compared to last year, I think organizationally it's quite difficult to navigate this year because you have different pickup spots all over town. There's no walk-in site. You have to pre-register online with an email. I talked to people this morning, and they're like, how do I get on that thing? Well, you have to send an email. Do you have access to the computer? And she's like, I don't do computers. Well, that woman has no access to the winter shelter. That's not a very good program. But if she's already within the program, like if a person shows up to one of these bus stops, shuttle stops, and they do have a light night, they will take people on.
What's a light night?
I think they're pushing 60 at max. So if it's like a couple nights ago, they only had 35 people a couple of nights ago, and sometimes 40. I think it's been very infrequent that they've maxed out. It's usually the cold nights that bring people out. But I want to, tip my hat to Jeffrey Harris. He's captaining the program this year. I don't mean captain like Salvation Army. He's running it. Mm-hmm. And, it's a difficult job he's got. So it's easy to be critical. But I think it's the city that was trying to help but put all these stop gaps. And I'm trying to work with the city desperately right now, too. But like the inability to access the Salvation Army as they had last year. 2 years ago, they had to show up at the Boneyard way the fuck up River Street, right? The stupidest location for a walk-in shelter, and then get shuttled all the way back down to Salvation Army. That's the stupidest thing anybody had ever designed. Then last year, finally, brilliantly, they allowed people to walk onto the Salvation Army. But that challenges the neighborhood, and any neighbor to the Salvation Army, you and I included, would have had some concern because that just imports the entire population of people seeking shelter right into your front yard.
Did it actually cause any real problems that you heard of that you think were substantive in terms of theft or crime, or was it simply apprehension?
Neighbors always point to an increase in property theft. And so that's hard to challenge, like, cars getting broken into or, bikes being brought out of backyards. So
Did you hear the police gave any account that this was backed up by reports, or did you?
No. What happened was complaints bore heavily on city government, they demanded, as the build-up towards this year, that not be a walk-in site, and the city acquiesced.
Right, but I'm talking about whether there actually were real problems.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I'm. That's my.
I never heard one. They actually had a very tight. You had to, once you got onto the campus, you were trapped. You were not able to leave. That's one of those things you can complain about that style shelter. That a lot of people can't be at a place like that. You can't be at a place that you can't even leave your bed spot and walk outside to have a cigarette because that's. A good 5% of your population are cigarette smokers, and they have to smoke.
What I heard and what Pamela Comstock and I disagreed with when she was on the council, but she eventually agreed, is that 70% of the homeless population in 2013 smoked, compared to 17% of the general population.
Impossible. Those numbers are impossible to generate, though.
Well, she got that from a Massachusetts study, and I did too. But I mean, who knows?
Right.
Having
used the pit count myself two times in a row, which is the only local, every number you hear somebody spout
commenting about homeless numbers, you're just going to go, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
You should try to do the count 1 year and then come back and tell us about data.
So it should be said that your storage program, whereas your warming center program could only serve a limited number of people, and you also self-limited yourself in terms of the temperature or the rainfall when you would open.
We have no limit.
Well, limited in the sense of when you opened the program. In other words, you decided, at a certain temperature because of your staff limitations and your resource limitations.
Yeah.
But compare that to the fact that apparently your storage program does not have that limitation right now. As I understand it, you take anybody who shows up pretty much.
Anybody who can agree to the basic agreements, and that actually does filter out a fair amount.
How many people would you say are filtered out? What percentage?
I would say it's usually the one rule that seems to filter people out are they have to be no repeated disruptions while they're in the space. And that's what we've seen are people who are agitated in a emotionally violent way. Hmm. We want to help them as much as we can, but if they're not chilling out in the space and they're creating a dangerous dynamic, and this is not just people with mental health challenges. That's not who we're talking. That's who we might think. But a lot of people who have stolen material, who are on methamphetamine, who may be aggressively violent, have real challenges with authoritarian issues. With somebody saying, "Please, I need you to move your bike from that spot over to this spot." If they can't just follow a simple rule like that without having a huge blow up. So we've turned, I think 5 or 6 people away just on that basis.
Out of how many people, though, of a total population?
We currently have over 175 people.
So that's that's an extremely small turnaway percentage.
Though. Oh, yeah. Organizationally, it's funny because we care so much to help even those people. We're challenged, like, how do we help that guy stay in the program? How do we use our language in such a way that the terms these days it's called trauma-informed care. How do we not trigger that? It's a challenge, but some people are just raw nerved waiting to be triggered.
Now you do the Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz website when you're when you find a spare second or two.
Oh, yeah, Facebook page, yeah.
And have any reports, because the one thing the city has apparently allowed to happen is this Ross encampment, the encampment behind Ross's Dress for Less, or whatever it is. Can you hold for a second? We've got an incoming call here.
Yes, sir.
Don't go away. And all you listeners, hold too.
Okay,
we're back again. And so, have you been out much to Ross? I just got a call about someone was wondering who's paying for the Ross porta potty out there, the porta potty that appeared, I guess, last week or so.
Yeah, two of them.
Two of them appeared, and I've heard some uncomfortable reports about Ross from a few people at the Thanksgiving meal where I was at yesterday or day before yesterday, giving out different literature that I usually do. But what's been your perspective on that, and do you have any information about who's paying for the shitters?
I only know from a parks worker, a ranger of note. I won't name the person, but they're
no names, please.
Personal friend, a friend of the program. We've been, of course, as a community, marking the increase of this camp. This is just exactly like what happened in San Lorenzo Park. It's a place where law enforcement and rangers are directing people towards. It's very limited in size. It's far less adequate than the encampment at in San Lorenzo Park. Maybe in other ways it's better, but it's the reason it's, well, firstly, it's on city property or state park property managed by the city. I think I've been told by Susie O'Hara, I think that's incorrect. I think that's a mistake because I think the place down behind, whatever. The city is taking responsibility for this exactly like they did last year in San Lorenzo Park. So the city knows now it's on them. Last year at this time they put porta potties in San Lorenzo Park because of a call for, firstly you can't have open defecation. How are those people, relieving themselves? So it's the city who has installed those porta potties.
potty.
And they didn't want to allow the homeless to use the bathrooms, so they put in the porta potties.
Correct. There are no bathrooms anywhere near this location. So it's the right. It's the bare minimum, and they put a lot of garbage containers over there, like just plastic ones. It's exactly like they did last year.
Although, are there wash stations as well, or just...
I think there's a wash station, yeah, hand washing station next to the porta potty. That needs to be industry-wide. I think the porta potty companies are loving it because they get this other amenity that they get to rent out with every porta potty. But, yeah, it's got to be standard fare, especially with people who sleep outside and no place to wash. Uh-huh. So increased porta potties, increased bathrooms, and then like they did before, they're just kind of waltzing through once or twice a day. I don't mean waltzing, dancing. They're patrolling the space. Mm-hmm. And I went over there a few days ago to share some blankets and a bunch of warm gear and then information, because we're just right across the footbridge. In fact, as we're talking, I'm looking at the encampment right now outside of our office window. Mm-hmm. So we're very close to this encampment physically. But it's strange because this type of encampment is not a set of people generally who go to the winter shelter. This is a subset, and I always call it the Wild West camp, but I don't want to speak down about these people. But you end up with a circumstance like this with people who, it's the strongest, most dominant type person, or the person with the most collective power. And sometimes in a camp like this, it's about access to illegal or addictive substances, mainly methamphetamine and heroin. Which is kind of interesting. People gather together in with the ability to make purchases, so it becomes, you see, a buyer's club generating, meaning a bunch of people who can access things that they normally can't with a small amount of money that they have. Additionally, the worst of all, it becomes a clearinghouse for people who are bringing in stolen goods, people who are selling their bodies for access to substances. So I call it Wild West because it's just it's an economy based on addiction and desperation. Very dangerous there.
Have you had much contact with many of the people over there in terms of, spending much time talking to folks in the tents? And because I know at one time a year ago you were interested in this Union of the Homeless or Coalition of the Homeless in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, the idea that people in any encampment should realize that they can have collective power and speak with one voice if they agree on things. What we found in San Lorenzo Park is some of the things that we wanted to bring up, like we have a problem with theft in this camp. Do we want to talk about it? Which means people going into each other's tents and stealing things, or new people being directed into the encampment and immediately having their stuff just liquidated every time they step away from the encampment, or violence in the camp. So you bring up, what are the needs that we have? Fresh water, drinking water. We want to talk about the things that they're citing us for, which often is like cigarette smoking or having an open container. Whereas, can the city begin to address some of the basic needs that we have as human beings in a community that's been produced by some measure by the city itself? So,
have you had many of those conversations with people at the Ross camp?
No, zero. Well, all I do over there is I say, here's a hotline if you have extreme situation, you need blankets. We have right across the bridge is a place where you can store your valuable belongings, so you don't have to worry about them, keeping them safe here all the time. And just conversations like that. Surprisingly, surprised how many people are in this camp who were in the last year's San Lorenzo encampment. That's amazing that the population kind of, they know each other. They know who they are, what they're about. And so now, this year, when I enter that encampment, I kind of can see the structure, community structure going in, and I'm just like, how to help people who are not trying to be helped. It's when we look at homelessness through the lens of this camp, it's not helpful.
Well, let me ask you this, how many people that you do talk to end up using your services there over there?
I think we have a number of people who are using the services prior to that camp being established. I would say maybe 10% of the people in that campment are storing things here.
Because they have their own tents. Do you hear much about theft in that particular campground, or you say you just really don't have information about that?
Oh, no, right away, as soon as the city started telling people to go there, the story spiked. You know, it's almost like throwing the lambs to the wolves. You know, it's like, it sounds like I have the worst story, you know, view of all, but I've got people who are dedicated users of the storage program who've been camping at the lower levee, and they slowly start to migrate up here to be closer to the day and night storage, camping in areas, for instance, like that exercise gym area right by Ross in the parking lot along the levee, or further down or more into the Sash Mill zone, places like that, who the city said, no, you can't be here, go to that encampment. And as soon as it's at the encampment, the second they stepped away, everything was gone. Or
how many reports did you have of that?
About 3 or 4 reports right away. Mm-hmm. So we're like, I'm just trying to work with these people who are, you know, they want to have a day tent. If you can have a tent over there, why not go to the winter shelter at night and have a day tent over there? You know, people need a place to congregate and still, you know, have some space. So, like, our whole encouragement is never leave anything alone, break your tent down, keep your most valuable things. We're seeing a lot of, there's a guy over there, I won't say his name, but he understands the hardship of people having their wallet and purse, backpack stolen, and then having all of their cards and data and paperwork are the most difficult thing for somebody to acquire, from birth certificate to Social Security to, you know, finally California state ID, so you can access SSI and other things like that. When somebody takes the backpack with all of that in it, you're now in a devastation that's going to sometimes take as many as 6 months to a year, because people don't have foot access as easily, and they don't live with a computer. So anyway, there's this one guy who's picking up the bags. As soon as people steal something, they go through the bag for the things that they're looking for, usually money, you know, tools, substances, drugs, whatever. And then they'll just litter the bag nearby. See, this guy goes through all of those belongings and brings the cards and puts them in our mail slot. So I now have this new program where I'm trying to reach out to the people whose IDs are here. So, and many of those are usually not with the encampment. They're people who have, you know, put their bag down by a bench downtown, looked away. Anyway, but let me say some more positive things about this encampment real quick. It is a space where people who are sleeping outside, who have various interpersonal challenges around substances or mental health, or the places where people are being directed to by the law enforcement, and they are now in community. And when people are in community like that, you can now reinforce community values, and that's the thing we were trying to do last year. Like, what, now that you're here, what are your demands of each other? What are your agreements? And so that's what I would encourage activists to be focusing on, rather than making it using these encampments. You know, Santa Mierda is calling it Camp Bernal, adorably.
Santa Mierda, of course, is the anti-homeless, they're a bunch of shit website, right?
Yeah. So when we talk about protest camps or something like that, what I wish that we had were some activists who would be, you know, use some elbow grease, you know, go down into the encampment and hang out there, find out who's there, just kind of gather a few stories, and then really, like, what's possible in an encampment like that? What's possible? So here we stand at the precipice of the next change. Again, last year, They cleaned it out several times. I think 4 times they did camp cleans every 2 weeks, if you recall, in San Lorenzo Park, finally leading towards a city-organized encampment at 1220 River Street. So the question is, and I think the ranger that I'm speaking of has told me, that camp is temporary. You know, it'll be moved out at some point, probably after the holidays. So we're thinking, you know, they're probably going to get us like they did last year through Christmas and New Year, and then after New Year, probably is going to be they'll close that, and then where will people go from there? But between now and Christmas, you know, they've already had, I think, unreported drug-related death in the camp, and then an official death in a car in front of Ross, who was an OD, likely attributable to drugs procured at the encampment. So what do we say in this moment? How do we keep people safe? I know that people like last year, Denise Ellerick was going into the encampment and Tia, a nurse at the Homeless Services Center, and trying to focus on Narcan and focus on letting people know that, how to address overdoses. That's where you go, like what happens when what happened in the encampment last year, we saw females taking their first hit of methamphetamine into their an artery in their neck and having it not be a good experience, and two girls died when that occurred.
How many times did you see that happen or hear of that happening?
That happened twice. Mm-hmm. That was when I became kind of a freak using that term drug camps, because then a couple other men died, a total of four known deaths, overdoses in that camp last year. And we just don't want that repeated this year. We're not having a conversation about that.
How does that compare with overdoses, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago when there was no camp? So yeah, that would be my question. You've just characterized it perhaps accurately as a buyer's area, people are more likely to overdose. It's always been my impression that when there is a community, people are less likely to overdose. But, maybe not. But again, it's hard to say. And I know you've often given the impression in these interviews that it's more of a peril. And you said this actually more recently, for people to be in this camp than, let's say, to be sleeping on the street of the Pacific Avenue where Take Back Santa Cruz hounds can hound them. I'm sorry, can you hold one more time?
Yeah.
Thank
you.
Appreciate that. Hang on. And listeners, you hang on too. And we're back. So you still feel that that's pretty much the case, that it's more dangerous to be in the camp than to be on the street, or is it impossible to say?
No, it's dangerous for somebody who was sleeping on a bench, who is now being directed to be in that encampment, who is not a part of that community, and they may have a source of income that can be is representative in their purse or backpack, so they become it becomes perilous for them. Their source of income might be stolen. If they don't have a friend or a buddy looking out for them, it's a dangerous scenario.
Well, so since a lot of people are being directed to that camp, what kind of advisory do you have for them?
We're just telling people to keep the things that you can't. You'd be devastated if you would have lost in the day and night storage program. Don't carry your documents around anymore. You don't even carry your ID. You can keep money with us. It's just that we should, we're calling it Get With The Program. That's our new cute little catchphrase. Leave your bedding off in the morning, pick your most important stuff up during the day, then leave it off at night, pick your bedding up again. Develop some sort of daily program so that you can keep your stuff safe, be interacting with a group of people who care about you every day. It becomes not unlike a program. They get to check in. They're greeted by their name. If they need a dry pair of socks or a coat or increased bedding, anything like that, they can get with us. Hand warmers. Almost everybody takes a bottle of water. All these things are free of charge, donated. So that's what we're trying to encourage people within that encampment. But additionally, we're really trying to make sure that people in that encampment who might be possessing stolen goods aren't storing those items with us. We don't want to become that type of safe deposit box where people are able to. We think that we've seen a little bit of that at the former location. And it's really difficult for people to do that because we're in close quarters in the processing area. So we don't check what people are loading into their bins, but we're seeing mostly clothing, people managing their dirty laundry and clean laundry needs and bedding. Some people come, this is the most heartbreaking of all, they come and open up their bin only to look at family photos for 15 minutes and they put the family photos in and they leave on the daily. I never expected to see that. And that's kind of a heartbreaking scenario.
Let me ask you about some of the issues that concern HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and me around, let's say, the closure of the San Lorenzo Park with fencing. Is that reopened yet, as far as you could see?
No, it's not open. We're told that Grant Street is unlocked during the daytime now.
They're locking Grant Street during the daytime?
No, it had been locked last night. Now they're unlocking it.
Now they're unlocking it. What about the bathrooms at San Lorenzo?
Nope, still locked.
Loudon Nelson?
Still inaccessible to people who are not at a program within the facility.
City Hall?
City Hall only unlocked during chambers hours.
Right. Anything you've seen that maybe you've not yet been able to put up on homeless outside in Santa Cruz, you think?
I want to just mention one other bathroom that we'd like to have people remember. It's the Depot Park bathroom. Very big, utilitarian, great space. It's close to the Loudon Nelson and accessible to that 7-Eleven by the tracks. So I always want to keep reminding people that that's a really accessible bathroom.
What are the hours?
I think 9 o'clock.
And of course, then there are the county bathrooms, which are good during the weekdays if you can get to them. County building bathrooms.
Yeah.
Anything else outside that have you noticed any other encampments forming? Had any other experiences you want to pass on?
Yeah, the beachfront encampment. I haven't visited there much. We're told that the city is allowing. They're allowing people to.
They were, and then they drove it away. Drove people to Depot Park, and at Depot Park, Parks and Rec picked up their stuff and trashed it, is what I'm told. Is that what you hear?
Yeah.
Right.
One second, I'm dealing with it. All right. What time is it?
It is now about 3:40.
Yeah, people are already arriving to the store.
Well, let me let you get back to work. You've done a lot of passed on information. Thank you, Brandon. People want to reach you, of course. Your phone number is 423-1234.
246-1234.
Whoops, sorry. Why did I say? I'll try to get that one together. Thank you, Brandon. I appreciate it. 246.
1234. All right, thank you, Robert. Be well.
Bye-bye. And that was Brent Adams of the Day and Night Storage, and we've got some more stuff coming in, perhaps.
What if, no matter how angry he was, how outraged he was, how furious he was, what if, no matter how angry he was, he couldn't lay hands on a gun? He couldn't lay hands on a gun. And what if, no matter how right he was, how wrong they were, how evil they were, what if, no matter how right he was, he couldn't lay hands on a gun? No, he couldn't lay hands on a gun. No Uzi automatic, no assault gun tonight, no repeater, no explosive, no machine gun tonight, no clips crammed with bullets anywhere to be found, no weapon just laying around. And what if, no matter how outraged he was, how furious he was, how murderous he was, what if, no matter how outraged he was, he couldn't lay hands on a gun? He couldn't lay hands on a gun. He just couldn't lay hands on a gun. Thank you.
And that was Tom Paxton from the Unnaugural 2018, Part 7 on YouTube. Tom Paxton and Magpie and Finale is how it's titled here. You're tuned to the stream of free radio, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. This show is called Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, and we're rolling right along. I'm not normally a terribly strong fan of gun control. I tend to be more looking for gun control in terms of authorities having guns taken away from them. I suppose I wouldn't mind if everybody got their guns taken away, but so heavily armed are the police that it, well, you're not going to get a fair shootout anyway, for sure, but it always bothers me that gun control advocates have such confidence in the police departments. It just doesn't make sense given the kind of killings, unaccounted and unaccountable killings that are going on. And I'm going to be, I think, reading something about that shortly. So here's a story in the San Francisco Chronicle from Tuesday, November 20th. Mother accuses Danville police of shooting man over skin color. The mother of a man shot to death behind the wheel of his car by Danville police has filed a claim against that city, alleging that his only crime was being the wrong skin color in Danville. Attorney John Burris made that statement in a claim his office filed Friday with the Danville City Attorney's Office. That's last Friday, Friday before last, actually, looks like. The claim, which California requires to be filed and denied before a lawsuit can be filed against a government agency, seeks in excess of $25,000. It was filed on behalf of Jeannie Atienza, the mother of Vladimir Arbeleda. Let me say that again. Arbeleda, I believe it is. Arbeleda, 33, of Newark, was shot to death November 3rd in the affluent East Bay suburb of Danville by Danville police officer Andrew Hall, a five-year veteran of the force. Authorities said Hall feared that Arbeleda was trying to run him down in an escape attempt. A couple of quick side notes here. This, of course, last week, or actually last city council meeting, it looks like, whether it was a city council meeting, this, well, the city council agreed to pay off Sean Arlt as relatives for the murder of Sean Arlt 2 years ago, about 2 years ago now. And we've never gotten the documented witness reports, all the video and audio, or had a real accounting of the officer who killed him, or heard of any kind of discipline that that officer was subjected to. Part of that has to do with the structure of protective privilege set up by the police agencies through the state legislature. Part of it has to do with the timidity of city council members and the tendency of the city manager to work hand in glove with the police department, not to want to reveal what's really going on in the police department, to allow them to have their own sort of private little chamber, their secrets, their sort of insulated area. So what happens is some of the relatives get paid off after 2 years, but the same policies continue. There's no indication of a real change in policies. So instead, you get essentially kind of a hush money thing happening, and it's pretty nasty, pretty damn nasty. I've been trying to get the new police chief, not new anymore, but Andy Mills, to answer questions of the old police chief, Kevin Vogel, you know, the guy who concealed an ICE agent in his police department for 9 years, you know, the guy who probably lied about police involvement in the ICE raids of 2 years ago, the guy who was not held accountable for this. He wasn't fired by the city council. He did, retire, no doubt, with nice, hefty benefits and made lots of continued, well, some anti-homeless denunciations of homeless people in San Lorenzo Park in last year's campground. Well, he has a right to his opinion. He's, but he's doesn't have a right to abusive behavior on the community and concealing, and nor does Andy Mills have a right to conceal stuff from the community that he, and not just he, but other police departments also are concealing as some sort of special Praetorian guard with special privileges. The issue here in this Arbeleda killing or murder is the claim by the officer that Arbeleda was trying to run him down in a car. And I requested of Andy Mills many, many months ago to give us the policy regarding the police department's, how it stands on having a vehicle. If you're in a vehicle, do you have a right to, if someone is in a vehicle and is, and a police officer decides that they want to shoot that guy down because, police officer decides he'll stand in front of the vehicle and demand the person stop, and if they don't stop, he'll just kill him. Is that an acceptable strategy, or is that what's the use of force policy? I couldn't get a straight, clear, specific answer from Andy in spite of repeated requests, nor has the ACLU made such a request, nor has Steve Plaich, who's on the board of the ACLU and was for a while vice chair, as far as I know, made such a request. But that is an example of the kind of information withholding that has been happening on a variety of fronts in the Santa Cruz Police Department. And I interrupt this story about Danville because Danville is miles away from here. What's really of concern to locals is what's going on here. And that's what's of concern to me and what we actually can do something about. We can't put much pressure on Danville, nor really should we. It's their community that needs to be doing that. It's our community and our police department that needs to be forced to walk a straight line. Continuing the story by Michael, I think it's Cobana Tuan. The shooting has raised questions about the controversial practice of police firing on moving vehicles. Such tactics are banned in many cities, including San Francisco. Police said they received a call about 11 a.m. of someone acting suspiciously and walking towards several homes with bags in his hands. When officers approached Abelita, police said, he fled in his silver Honda sedan. He pulled over twice, authorities said, as if to surrender before driving away. But at Front Street and Diablo Road, Arboleda allegedly veered toward officers approaching his car on foot. Burris released a statement saying Arboleda had not committed a crime or an infraction. And the attorney said a witness has come forward to contradict the police department's account of the incident. Arboleda was trying to drive slowly around a police cruiser and not attempting to strike Hall, Burris said. Hall, the police officer, recklessly decided to deprive Mr. Arboleda of his life when he had no information that he had committed any crime, Burris said. Again, an example of, you don't follow my orders, you're going to pay, mister. And that's the kind of authority and attitude that is given to police officers by the kind of power they have and that the community has essentially surrendered to them. The officer had an option, but chose death over life, said Burris, the attorney. Contra Costa County Sheriff David Livingston released a statement slamming Burris for, quote, playing the race card, and called Arboleda dangerous and reckless. This is a tragic case, yet once again, John Burris is reaching for his well-worn race card. This is not about race. This is about a dangerous and reckless person trying to run down and murder a police officer. Once all investigations are completed, we look forward to sharing the full details with the public, Livingston said. So notice that this police chief, I think it's a police chief, no, sheriff, hasn't completed the investigation, but he's made up his mind what's going on, and he is simply denouncing Burris and coming to the conclusion, as the police frequently seem to do, that it's clear that this must have been a bad guy because he got killed by the police. I mean, police only kill bad guys, right? And occasionally bad girls. Burris said the lack of a ban on shooting at moving cars runs contrary to recommended police practices and Department of Justice guidelines. What's the status of Santa Cruz? Well, Police Chief Andy Mills told me, here's the entire set of police general orders, and he sent me 780 pages of it. And I put it online. I think I put it online. I've done that before. I got to see if I've actually done that more to this most recent thing. And it was months ago that I made this Public Records Act request. But when I wrote him back, I said, I can't find it. And I'm, you know, I may be not looking in the right place. Can you please direct me to the specific policy regarding use of force against vehicles? But Police Chief Mills was too busy to do that. Or perhaps he didn't like my tone. I don't know. Who knows? The claim in Danville alleges wrongful death, negligence, and negligent hiring and training. It seeks an unspecified amount of money for general damages, including pain, suffering, and emotional distress, as well as medical and related expenses. And that's a story in the San Francisco Chronicle from a week ago, more or less, by Michael Cabana Tuan. And again, there's the same problem with this Burris lawsuit, is that it's going to get money for the victims, perhaps. They'll do a settlement. But you won't get a trial. You won't get the officer being held accountable. You won't get any meaningful changes in police policy other than the assurances that there'll be better training. You know, it's Santa Cruz police officers have had better training for some time. At least there's been some, I would ask if the Santa Cruz Police Department doesn't make the same claim of, or didn't make the same claim 3 years ago, right before Sean Arlt was killed. And I would wonder what changes have happened in the training that should have us be more confident that this isn't going to happen again, or that this just isn't a tool in the box of the police department. Let's take a musical break.
Thank you. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. Help us sing that. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. Across the bridge at Selma, you came marching side by side. In your eyes, a new world on the way. Hope was in your heart and justice would not be denied. You sang, we shall overcome someday. God knows the courage you possessed. And Isaiah said it best. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. Marching round the White House, marching round the Pentagon, marching round the mighty missile plants, speaking truth to power, singing peace in Babylon, asking us why not give peace a chance. God knows the courage you possessed, and Isaiah said it best. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk. You sing it yourselves now, ready? How that's what I call a choir. Now the generations who have joined you on this road look to you with power in their eyes. Now you know the torch has passed as they take up the load. Now you see their eyes are on the prize. God knows the courage they possess. And Isaiah said it best. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. How beautiful upon the mountain are the steps of those who walk in peace. Are the steps of those who walk in peace.
And that was another from Tom Paxton and the inaugural 2018. And that's an older Tom Paxton, but Paxton was around at the same time that Phil Oakes was. And here's a song from Rehearsals for Retirement called I Kill, Therefore I Am, which kind of more suits the spirit of the last article that I read. So now we're going to rejoin the Conscience in Action. Well, it's actually the Huff meeting that happened. Yeah, it's a mixture of the two. Huff and Conscience in Action kind of get together. They're groups that just kind of switch off on Wednesdays at 11 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe on 703 Pacific next to the Bike Church. If you want to check them out, they're open meetings. You're welcome to come. I think if you're a police officer, you have to stand outside the fence. Sub Rosa does not allow police officers in its building unless they are there on official business with a warrant or perhaps an invitation. I don't know they've ever been invited in. In any case, last show I did the first half of this kind of audio of part of the meeting, and we were listening to a guy talking about his removal from the beach after a week of apparently being told it was fine to be on the beach in a tent with tents up during the day down in the main beach, and then being forced away by Andy Mills himself and told to go to Depot Park, where he came to find Parks and Rec rangers taking people's property, putting it in a truck, and either disposing of it or stashing it somewhere else. And also you'll hear the voice of Jane, who lost a lot of her property, and Christopher. Well, these folks will tend to speak for themselves, and I'm going to play the rest of this now because it, you be the judge of how credible this stuff is. It sounds pretty specific to me. When people talk specifically, their credibility tends to increase in my eyes. So let's hear them.
And they're coming back down. They're like, Jane, you're just too much paperwork and they don't pick me up. And I go, okay, I got to watch the dog. I got to watch this. I got to do this.
Because they pick up everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm left sitting there going, I can't even go to the library. They are all Irish and God bless them and they are great. But you know what I mean? It's getting a bit out of hand with the way this stuff is going. One of the guys even got took up the other night because he was playing his guitar 1 meter. And I went, who's using metric in America? This is a cracker. And he goes, you're 1 meter away from an ATM. So we got a ticket.
Playing guitar without a sign.
Without nothing.
But there was
And it's illegal to be within 50 feet of an ATM in a seated position. It's illegal to play a guitar with a display device. That is an open cap or an open guitar case, unless you are inside the boxes that are downtown on Pacific Avenue, which are at least in that area. You cannot be seated on the sidewalk anywhere else. You can't panhandle anywhere else. You can't busk anywhere else outside those small kind of square disked areas that are, I think they're 3x3 or 2x3. I'm not quite sure what the actual measurements are at the moment. But there are a few of them, and they're on very broad sidewalks that have no rationale other than an attempt to make it more difficult for people. And it puts them in cages and little boxes and gives the police the opportunity to give them $300 tickets, $200 to $300 tickets. And that's the cost of these citations, which, of course, people can't pay. So they go to collection with another $200 or $300 added. And that goes to their credit rating and other problems, getting a driver's license. And sometimes this stuff can be worked off, but it in the sense that it can be dealt with through some of the famous programs that we've heard that the DA and the police and the social service agencies supposedly get together to help people with, where help means we'll let you do this if you don't come downtown anymore, if you get out of town. It's a question essentially of you exchange your rights and you'll get this whole series of bogus tickets written off for you. That's how I see it. Now, some would describe it differently. Some would describe it as an aid for people who have, you know, suddenly been engaged in a lot of improper behavior, where improper it really means against these ordinances. This infamous downtown ordinances have been set up in Santa Cruz. But sometimes there are other things, you know, drunk in public. But again, in Santa Cruz, you can get a ticket for having an open container in public. Unless, of course, you're drinking wine in a sidewalk cafe, which is perfectly okay. Anyway, back to Conscience in Action's reports about new harassment by the police of campsites and people who are sleeping, in spite of the Martin versus Boise decision, which held that you can't arrest, cite, harass, or otherwise accost people for, I was going to say, survival behavior, but at least specifically it is to sleep or rest in public spaces. And it's not quite as universal or as sweeping as that. It says that laws which make that a crime broadly in a city can't be enforced unless there are actually shelters available that would accommodate the population of people that they are criminalizing, in essence. And since that isn't the case in almost any city in this country, well, at least any large city, and certainly not in Santa Cruz, that means the cops are supposed to lay the fuck off. But do they? Well, Mills claimed he was doing that for the last year, and to some extent, in some cases, he did. But it's all very circumstantial. He'll turn right around and tell people that, no, what I told you yesterday isn't going to be true today, so you can just move at my whim. And then when you get there, you'll get your stuff taken. He didn't say that, but that apparently is the account of some of these folks that came to the Conscience in Action meeting.
It was nothing got to do with the guitar. I didn't find out about the guitar till 2 days later. It was actually from the officer himself. He says, Jane, I said, how are you, Patrick? Irony. And I said, what's going on? He goes, you been good? I said, yeah, well, obviously I'm conked out.
So, but let me get back, Jane, to this. How long were you at the Depot Park before you were forced away?
No, I was told to go to the Depot
Park. But after you were there, you've left the Depot Park, right?
Because all my stuff is gone.
Now, so it wasn't the police that told you to leave. It was theft in the area.
Oh, yeah. Everyone
plus
up there
the
is gone. The Rangers are flying around. I got told by the police, you're up to an hour allowed to sit on the bench that we drink on in the morning, where I have a can of beer. And then I go for my breakfast. And then I head on to St. Francis. Then I get my stuff done up at the HPHP. And then I'm in the Scots Valley Library. And then I go to my storage unit. And then I go meet my ex-fiancé. And we do stuff at our old house. And we get everything done. And it's like life is trying to move on. But this is absolute madness where I can't even go 10 minutes without, like, literally. Like, that's why everyone's calling me Pebbles. I can't even go and wash my hair. There's literally someone turn around going, Jane, this drama's going on. And I'm like, I'm plain Jane, not Calamity. I don't want this malark.
It gets under your skin, this feeling
it
of constant being constantly under attack,
speaking.
And it makes us be harsh
you
to each other.
You don't realize how many men I have in my tent, and I am not Cleopatra or Helen of Troy.
And Christopher, how have you been involved in this?
I find myself... At first, I was a victim of circumstance, you know. I'll be going along, you know, trying to sleep or getting really frustrated. I'll wake
that was
up
peachy.
Frustrated at everything.
How long have you been in town?
I've been in town about
4 years
two months,
in January.
Well, 2 months, 4 months. And I used to live around here. I lived around here all the time. And
indoors or outdoors?
Very good question.
That's a damn good question. Mostly outdoors, actually, because it's so nice around here.
Now, this time you were in Depot Park with Jane, or
I don't really hang out at Depot Park. None of those really sound familiar.
I've only met there in the last month,
and I see it more
as a
military base. Therefore, it should be a historical landmark or monument area.
Have you been hassled where you've been sleeping?
Occasionally.
And what about the last week?
In what concept?
Basically, when I get comfortable, or if I'm trying to smoke and lay down, I got to get up and go do something and go somewhere else. And it's like...
Go for a pee-pee.
It's a psychological thing that I don't... I just got married to this really, really beautiful woman. And...
good for you. I love the way you elbowed me for that. I'm going to take that as a compliment.
And I don't want anybody to steal away our good time, and I don't want everybody to come in and realize that it's just a really intimate
You're in
situation.
Your cocoon.
Christopher, any threats of tickets or seizure of property from police or Parks and Rec?
I got my first ticket.
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. Right. If you're not doing anything wrong, if you don't have a tent set up, if you don't have all these things, then you have nothing wrong. But
have you been in the same spot for the last week?
No. if you can pick up your stuff and walk away with it, I have no problem. I walk around with my blankets, or I put them down, and that's about it.
You're carrying your stuff with you these days?
I carry my stuff with me. That's basically.
And in the rain, is that difficult?
We call it rain, but this is the fog moving back into the area. It's we get down to 21 at night. I mean, sometimes it seems down to crisp, like negative 29, and then 63 in the day. But now the fog's rolling back in. It's like rain. It's going to stay like this because now it's just kind of like a nice 63 calm. Everybody else moved out of the area. They thought it was, you know, super summer awesome. It's, what, November? You know, it's
so, Jane said you got a ticket, Jane. Would you want to say anything about that?
I got my first ticket ever in my life. I've no criminal record. I don't even have a jaywalking. You too, sir. Thank you so much.
Gobble to you, buddy.
And I got my first ticket. The one I can tell you, this is so embarrassing because I'm ex-military. I'm Irish Defence Force, 2-star cadet in the Irish Defence Force, where I was a Styrog rifle, and I was being trained to actually look after the tanks to go to the Lebanon. And you know, the woman came up with a yellow ticket to me on the beach, and I started to cry, going, "Is it like a spider?" I was like such a girl. I turned into such a girl. Yeah. You can go hard, or you can go home. No, I went home, and so yeah. No, she handed me the ticket, and I was like, does this break my neutrality? And because I'm a documented citizen, and I'm in the process of getting my U.S. and my visa. Is this
good? It's terrifying.
And she was there going, and she was there, and I was there with a cup of tea. No joke. They didn't.
Where did you get the ticket, Jen?
I got the ticket because I was 1 hour after dark light. So technically, it's from sunrise to sunset.
You were in a park.
Huh? One eyes. I was sitting on the beach outside the arcade. I was playing air hockey, and I'd won loads of money off the lads because I beat them up.
Now what?
That's it. I don't know. I think I have to pay $300.
What jurisdiction gave it to you? Was it a park ranger? Was it a cop?
They said the new guy that's after coming in Santa Cruz, the head general. He's sending them out. That's what they said. The quad bikes up to my tent last night.
Do you have a copy of the ticket?
ATVs.
Oh, no. The lads use them as shrapnel, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
So it's called
when
fire.
When was this ticket?
Last week, and the ones were two this morning.
And what were the two this morning for?
Well, it wasn't under my name. Even though it was my tent, but my tent was robbed, everything's robbed, my duvets, my comforters, everything.
You got a ticket?
No, not me personally, because I walked off because they knew it was me. I seen it was Patrick.
But do we know who else got tickets that you know about?
That's why the whole beach is cleared. There's 21 tents gone.
Greg, do you have any idea of who got tickets?
I can't give names. Sorry, sir.
No, I mean, how many, what kinds of tickets, what kinds of tickets were given?
Well, I've seen seven in an hour.
They came back twice, and then the third time, and then it was the week before, and then they said they want to clear before Thanksgiving. So, and then allegedly, we were told by the ranger before, the other guy that was photographing us, they said that they were going to say, well, we pay for these residencies, so why are we having to look at this? And I was like, girls... It was mainly girls. I said, you got to move them in, at least go around the edge, the perimeter. I said, you know, leave the beach clear. And they said, no, it's safer for us when we stay on our own. And I said, well, I stay on my own. I don't even have a tent. I just put a beach towel over me. And they were like, no. And then the quad bikes started coming around going, rum, 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 rum.
How many rangers were involved?
No, these were quad bikes. These were actually officers.
How many officers were involved?
Oh, there was two each time.
And how many tickets were given? You say two that you know.
Oh, there was 24 the first night.
24 tickets?
That's the one when I cried.
And when was that, do you know?
Yeah, it was like 12 days ago.
Okay. That was the day, like day after ago, Chief Mills was there? I think it was like the day after Chief Mills was there. That's when they... I mean, seven tickets in 1 hour.
It was the brunette woman that came up to me. She was beautiful, and she said, I'm sorry, I apologize, we're after getting a new boss in town. And I just heard them say it outside before I came in. They said, there's a new boss in town. And he says, I got to get this place cleaned up. So he's trying to do paperwork.
Mm-hmm. The new boss is probably Tony Elliott, who's the head of Parks and Rec. That's the only boss I could think of. So,
they definitely...
And Tony Elliott has not responded to questions and concerns that I've raised in a letter, which I think I read on the air, either in the last show or the show before, after we, in the Conscience and Action Group, met with him and asked him specifically to reopen the Loudoun Nelson bathrooms to the general public, to remove the fencing from the, or at least to give us some idea when the fencing would be removed from San Lorenzo Park and the bathrooms there reopened, or let us know what the actual kind of repairs were, how long they've been going on for, why they required closing the bathrooms, why the restoration in the San Lorenzo Park required closing the bathrooms, even though the restoration was happening elsewhere, why the entire area had to be fenced off, a whole series of questions which he has remained discreetly silent on, apparently is instead issuing or allowing his subordinates to issue tickets about in other places as well. So they've closed all the parks for fire, so-called fire danger. Well, I suppose it's real in spite of the rain. I'm not sure about that. But, of course, and they're herding everyone into this concentration camp area in the Ross campground. A concentration camp in the sense that it's a place where people are concentrated and also a place where they are crammed together. And other places where they've tried to seek out where they could, you know, themselves in smaller groups form their own sense of community because they have no legal place to go and because the courts have ruled they cannot be legally forced to, under threat of violence, because that's what police are, they're the threat of violence, to move on, give up their rights, give up their property. In spite of this, Santa Cruz police and rangers are operating as they always have. Apparently, probably at the behest of conservative residents and merchants, and around the Thanksgiving, let's all pretend we're having a wonderful gobbledy-gobbledy good time with everyone. You're going to hear more accounts of this later in this program from the Thanksgiving interviews that I did in the line outside the Vets Hall for the Thanksgiving meal.
They've been handing out tickets. They've just been waiting. Granted, they've all been deserved. They're ready, and they give them a 24-hour stay away every time they give a smoking ticket, any of those small tickets.
Annette from Felton.
So everybody disappeared really quick.
Annette from Felton that lives in the HPHP.
And this is a strategy used by police, which Mills claimed he was not using, which is to use tickets for other things, in essence, to go after people, to move them away from areas where they're simply resting or sleeping or socializing. It is a kind of a nasty, deceptive, but standard tactic used by police in other areas of the country. When the courts have essentially said stop harassing people for behaviors that they really have no choice about, which is to say to use public spaces to sleep, to cook, to take a crap if the bathrooms are closed. All these things are essential human functions that we necessarily have to do and we take for granted for ourselves if we live in homes or have access to homes or houses or facilities.
She is an actual registered, like, you know what I mean, like as in a citizen, like as in, like, you know, I'm here as a person that lives here, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm under the lease. She went out, and out of respect, she went the whole way across the road. You don't even need to. You just have to walk around the corner. She actually went over and sat across the curb, exactly like from here to here where the pumpkin is. She went over there, and she sat down, and she hid behind the car, and she had the cigarette. The cops came along and gave her a $350 ticket. And she goes, I live in there. I'm where Carl Street.
We talked about this actually 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago when you first showed up, Greg, which is what do you do when they come and scatter everybody? Because people need to be able to reassemble somewhere. You've got to be able to get back together and maybe form a new encampment somewhere if they want. I don't know. On the other hand, if you're losing your stuff, it may not, you know, you got to worry about the trust issues too. I haven't done any more work on this because it appeared last week or the week before that they were leaving people on the beach alone, but apparently they're not anymore.
It was a shock.
And also not at the Depot Park. Are they leaving people alone and it's just theft, Or are the Rangers also coming after people there?
They're on them. The Rangers are on them.
There's no answer, sir.
But there's no consistency.
I'm going to tell you honestly, there's no answer. Because no one could. This is like Jumanji. You got to play the game.
Is anybody getting tickets or threatened with tickets at the depot?
I'm going for a ticket.
At the depot for.
Well, I don't go up there. Okay. I'm not. I'm
so we don't really know what's going.
Yeah, right.
Some people are. Some people are getting tickets. Yeah.
You know, you have actual information that people are getting tickets to the depot.
But nothing like at the beach. It's more. It's a high visibility to. The public
they
at large.
They want you off the beach because it's coming up to Thanksgiving. That's what I got told unofficially.
They try to run away and go get high. When we know how to live,
they said they want you off the and smoke so they can make the money show. For the poshies to come down.
So let me ask now you, Aliza. Are you out at the Ross campground at all? No. Has anybody been out to Ross and know what's going on out there?
I just know that my friends that have been out there are disgusted. Just the human waste and the needles and the attitudes and the theft. They do have that porta potty now. I heard one, so they've got a shooting gallery added to their. It's just and a friend was. Given a ticket for just standing next to the river after work or the stream, whatever, down there by Ross, near there. And he was wearing his painter's clothes, and he was told by the two rangers that approached him that, well, we've got everything nice and contained and observed at the Ross Park area, and we just can't let people go straggling down here because who knows what you're up to. And he's like, I can't just relax after work and stare at a rolling stream, you know, going
down.
Was
he in a closed area?
There were no signs, and they said they were that the signs were ripped down in a flood.
What time of day was it?
I mean, I'm going to help this guy fight it.
You know what time of day it was?
It was probably about 4 to 4:30. He got off at 3, 3:30.
Oh, the areas are usually not closed unless it's for revegetation or other excuses.
Right. Yeah, but there were no signs. I need to go look at that, but he said that they flat out admitted that they'd been torn down in a flood, and they just, but they're definitely under, you know, they definitely are under orders to push people into certain areas.
We've been listening to accounts from
Greg,
from
Jane Marie Butler,
and from Timothy.
And Lisa, anything you've heard that you want to pass on?
Not really at the moment.
Okay, Greg, anything you want to say? You don't have to. Okay.
I just like to say, I just...
Plans first.
I just wish everything was more bohemian of the dream that I was told that was allegedly Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And if that would ever come to be again, well, sign me up. I'm there.
All right. So... And that was the Conscience in Action meeting last week, last Wednesday, at the Sub Rosa. Next Wednesday... On the, I guess it's going to be the 28th, there's another meeting of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. That starts at 11, and join us. It's we can quaff some coffee and share some accounts, and also consider essentially setting up a network of communication between campsites, folks outside, housed folks who want to be supportive around issues of essentially... restoring the right to sleep at night, have some place where you can be safe at night, as we've heard earlier talked about by Brent Adams. And for, I don't know, we can force the police to follow the law, but we can make it a little more difficult for them to act illegally with impunity. Here's a story from the East Bay Express. Federal judge blocks Oakland from removing homeless camp. Homeless residents are testing the scope of the recent Martin versus Boise decision in a bid to stop camp closures. A story by Darwin Bond Graham. And it's, oh gosh, well, it's only about a week old or less. November 13th. Oh, 2 weeks. At At a hearing in Oakland today, U.S. District Judge Haman Gilliam allowed a temporary restraining order preventing the city of Oakland from closing a homeless camp to remain in effect until at least November 26th, when there will be a second hearing to determine whether or not the city is violating the rights of homeless people. That's coming up, it looks like, on Monday, I guess. We'll learn more about that tomorrow, where tomorrow is the day after Sunday. The camp's residents allege that the city is violating their Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unusual punishment by effectively criminalizing camping and other life-sustaining activities without offering adequate shelter. They also allege the city is violating their 14th Amendment rights by denying them due process and equal protection under the law. That is, say, the cops just come in, take their property, force them to move, take away their liberties, in essence, without giving them the right to appeal that in court before it gets done. The case is one of the first legal tests to see just how far judges might go in interpreting the recent Martin v. Boise decision, in which the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that laws criminalizing homelessness are unconstitutional if a city isn't offering adequate shelter. The main thrust is under the Martin v. Boise case, Joshua Plovia Scott told Judge Gilliam during today's hearing. He said there are currently 300 to 350 shelter beds available in Oakland, while there are about 1,902 unhoused people, and I'm sure there are many more than that. Anita Morrell, one of the homeless Oakland residents who filed the case, wrote in a declaration that she attempted to call telephone numbers of shelters on the city's camp closure notice, but that most of her calls went unanswered. I was bringing up this issue in the last show with regard to Miley, the librarian's so-called free services list that she gives out on Thursday mornings at her coffee klatch in front of the library, and that is given out also on a website originally begun by Merity Wells, but which didn't originally have shelters on it because there is no shelter. There are waiting lists in Santa Cruz. There are closed waiting lists in Santa Cruz. There are claims you can get on a waiting list when you can't do that at all. There are programs that require you to have entrance requirements before you can get shelter, but there's no emergency shelter other than the 60 beds out at the 7th Avenue Veterans. I guess it's a veterans building, which Brent was talking about, which you have to get picked up at certain spots, and you have to sign up online, and you have to go through a series of hoops to get on. You can't walk up to the spot. It's for what little shelter there is, considering there's 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people in Santa Cruz, it's clearly we fall under the Martin v. Boise guidelines. But back to the story about Oakland. One shelter informed her they cannot accommodate pets, while another shelter told her they have no bed spaces. Another hotline she called informed her there are currently no shelter spaces available in the county. The plaintiffs, who now call themselves Housing and Dignity Village, kind of like the Portland Dignity Camp that became Dignity Village, which set up its own, seized its own place to sleep. Every night they went into a park. When the police drove them away, they picked up their shopping carts and rolled through town to another park until they eventually the city got tired of that and gave them a kind of a dumpy spot on the outskirts of town where they are currently and have been for the last almost 20 years now. The plaintiffs, who now call themselves Housing and Dignity Village, wrote in court documents that their camp is a clean and sober space that provides shelter mainly for women and children. Housing and Dignity Village is the latest in a series of protest camps that have sought to create self-organized communities of unsheltered people. They've often clashed with city officials over the issue of camp closures and the lack of resources like portable toilets at camps. First established in North Oakland's Grove Shafter Park in January 2017, the camp was closed by the city 1 month into its existence. I think I missed the camp by there by a day or two when I went up there to interview people there. A year later, many of the same activists, some of whom are homeless, reestablished the camp on a vacant city-owned lot in Fruitvale, but this site is scheduled to be closed due to construction activities. The new iteration of the camp was established on October 27th in the deep East Oakland neighborhood of Brookfield Village. On November 7th, Oakland police officers posted notices informing the camp residents they were illegally occupying the property, an empty lot owned by the city of Oakland. The notices informed residents that they should leave the area by November 10th. Assistant City Administrator Joe DeVries said after today's court hearing that he cannot comment on the lawsuit or the city's reasons for asking the camp to vacate the property. But Deputy City Attorney Jamala Jefferson said during the hearing that the city is worried the camp could expand in numbers and the structures might be built on it between now and November 26th, you know, to keep out of the rain, maybe? My goodness, or... I guess you can't shield yourself from the toxic smoke fumes from the Paradise fires, but you know, to provide a little privacy, these are things we can't allow these homeless vagabonds to have. I mean, it'll encourage more of them, you know. When the merits of the case on November 26th will be argued and when the judge is expected to issue a ruling, if this happens, it could end up costing the city more to remove the camp. So it's, you see, it's all a matter of dollars and cents. Jefferson had asked the judge withdraw the temporary restraining order, arguing that the homeless activists can't claim that their situation is similar to the Martin v. Boise case because the city of Oakland has no plans to arrest or cite homeless people for being at the camp. She added that the camp is located near a school, a senior center, and a library, all in a residential neighborhood, so naturally a threat to all three of those, right? The city is not arresting individuals, said Jefferson. Instead, she said the city's public works department is closing the camp and that there isn't any criminal law being enforced against the homeless. Of course, as in Santa Cruz, if you are in one of the areas that they suddenly decide to close, in Santa Cruz it's all the parks, then you're violating the law. And so the same effect is accomplished without actually giving you a ticket for the actual act of sleeping. Judge Gilliam declined to take a position, however, today, saying he needs to see actual records of what the city is doing in order to rule on whether or not it amounts to a possible violation of people's constitutional rights. Until the 26th, he asked the city and the homeless residents agree to take no further actions that would change the status quo, including any efforts to remove the camp or steps by the campers to move more people in and build structures. And that's the story in the East Bay Express on November 13th. There are also some comments, and here is a lengthy comment. We did not establish the encampment at 12th and 23rd Avenue. We were offered the land by the administration after City Council unanimously voted to do so, but rather than move forward with us in good faith, the administration, without talking to us, herded six encampments from five neighborhoods. Members of these encampments were in deep crisis and had lifelong and even intergenerational tensions between each other, and rather than stop the herding, the Oakland Police Department has continued to pick up individual homeless folks, sounds like Santa Cruz, and dump them on the land with the threat that if they leave, they will be arrested. The land is overcrowded, and we were never allowed the opportunity to have control of the site, nor the opportunity to build up our program there. But what we have done over the past year was attempt to stop people from killing each other, advocate for the residents of that encampment for basic sanitation services, which the mayor herself has refused, provide food and water, be first responders to murders and fires, get people to their doctor's appointments and court dates. None of us get the six-digit salaries of the city officials whose jobs it is to actually serve, or as they like to say, quote, manage the encampment. We are all volunteers, and many of us are homeless ourselves. Your anger is correct, but please direct it to the people responsible for the horrific and inhumane conditions the unhoused residents face. At least 12 have been forced to endure, and the impact it has had on the surrounding community. Due to their ill faith and their ill-fated actions, the administration has been pushed by City Council to grant us a new parcel of land on Miller Avenue, where we will actually be manifesting out our vision of an emergency shelter village with services. If you're interested in getting involved with our volunteer efforts at any of the services and advocacy we provide at 50 encampments through Oakland, feel free to contact me, and I'm going to give that number if anybody's interested who wants to hear it. In fact, there will be an all-volunteer and all-community-paid trash cleanup at the E-12th site, and this was some days ago, starting at 9 a.m. and again on Saturday at 10 a.m. as the city does not take care of the massive encampment it has created. And that's the phone number to contact this woman, who I don't have her name here, is 510-355-7010. I'm going to repeat that, 510-355-7010. And I may try to give her a call later, but here's a little music before we move on to probably more interviews, so stay with us.
When the kids are hungry, but there's nothing to eat. If the baby has a fever, but there is no heat. If they're living in the Chevy, while the world walks by. If the poor don't matter, then neither do I. If the poor don't matter, if the poor don't matter, if the poor don't matter, then neither do I. If they're living in the cardboard or the packing case, if they're gone by morning and they leave no trace, if nobody wonders if they live or they die, if the poor don't matter, neither do I. If the poor don't matter, if the poor don't matter, if the poor don't matter, neither do I. Push them back, sweep them out, anything to keep them out. Keep the Rio Grande out, standing with the hands out, knocking on the back gate, radio talking hate. Wrong here, strong, and no, they don't belong here. My house, my car, living like a rock star. Caviar, wet bar, bought another Jaguar. Got it all, payday, now it's time to play day. Trouble not to think about, not to make a stink about. If the poor don't matter, if we chase them away, we're gonna see them again, boys, on the judgment day. We're gonna see them again, boys, on the day we die. If the poor don't matter, then neither do I. If the poor don't matter, if the poor don't matter, if the poor don't matter, neither do I.